Good morning, everyone. I'd like to start with an acknowledgement of country this morning. We acknowledge this land that we meet on today as the traditional lands for the Kaurna people and that we respect their spiritual relationship with their country. We also acknowledge the Kaurna people as the custodians of the Adelaide region and that their cultural and heritage beliefs are still as important to the living Kaurna people today. We're gathered on Kaurna land this morning to speak with Susanna Moore. Hey, Susanna.
Hi, good morning.
Beg your pardon? Good morning or good evening. Susanna, some of you may in fact have met Susanna. She was a resident writer here at the University of Adelaide some years ago. What year was that, Susanna? Do you recall?
About 2008,
yeah,
2009.
Yes, around that time. And she was much beloved by the university community and the readers and others who met her, and indeed that's how I met her. She's been a guest at the Adelaide Writers' Festival since that time also. We hope to have her out here today, but the circumstances of her own life and health at present prevented that, so we're here on the big screen. Susanna is the author, among others, of the novels The Life of Objects, The Big Girls, One Last Look, In the Cut, Sleeping Beauties, The Whiteness of Bones, and My Old Sweetheart, the historical non-fiction I Myself Have Seen It, The Myth of Hawaii. And I'd also like to reference, as one of her great works, the eulogy that she wrote for her late great friend, lifelong friend, Joan Didion. It's online, it's very beautiful. It does exactly what Susanna does best, and she did this for her wonderful friend. It tells three short anecdotes about Joan, and it shows the character of Joan and fleshes out so succinctly the importance of Joan in her own life. That eulogy is online, and I would encourage you to have a look at that. It's beautiful, Susanna. Her most recent life work novel is the work of historical fiction, The Lost Wife. In between the busyness of writing and life, she also teaches myth and metaphor at Princeton University, and she lives currently, and I think that's where she'll remain now, in New York City. Susanna, when Louise consulted with me about the theme for this session, in which we focus on three of your works, in the Cut, your memoir. In Australia, Susanna, we say Miss Aluminium, but I notice in America you say Miss Aluminum, and I love that more luminous pronunciation of the word, so I will try to refer to it as that, and your most recent novel, The Lost Wife. It seemed to me that you often write, and I know your other work as well, you often write about women who are punished by men, and in your most recent novel, The Lost Wife, also by some other women for being too intelligent, too independent, too free-thinking, or some combination of these. And they're dangerous because they unsettle the prevailing power dynamics. So where to start? I think there's a lot to talk about, but perhaps we'll begin with your 1995 book, In the Cut, sometimes described as your breakthrough novel, a psychological thriller, and subsequently made into a film by Jane Campion, our own wonderful filmmaker, or New Zealand's. It's now also enjoying a resurgence of interest among a younger generation. But before we get to that resurgence, can you tell us why it is so different from your earlier novels, which were set in Hawaii, your childhood home? And it would be interesting for us to know what drove such a distinctive change in focus and genre.
I think I've always had a resistance to what was expected of me. But the first three books were very autobiographical, known rather grandiosely as the Hawaiian Trilogy. And I realized that I was being described and read as what is called a woman's writer, which I thought insulting to women and to me. And I decided that I would try to do something altogether different, different genre, different point of view. I first wanted to write about a male detective, a woman detective, but it was not working. So I switched it. I was surprised that it wasn't working. The woman was once again the victim, which was more true to what I had been experiencing because I had been volunteering and teaching in prison. So, and I also wanted to write about sex. I thought it had not been really written about in a way that interested me. That was the most daunting part because I didn't know how to do that or if I could do it.
Would you like to elaborate on that? Because I think the way in which you write about sex in this novel was one of the controversial things about it at the time, and I think it is distinctive.
Well, I read a lot of pornography, looked at a lot of images, not films, but print images, and I realized that what was not working, at least for me, was a description that involved the five senses, what something smelled like or tasted like or felt like. And so I decided that I would just write what was happening, in a kind of literal way, not in an imaginative or even sensual way, what they were doing. The couples, and it seemed to work, which surprised me. And it's been said that it worked because the lack of description allowed people to identify with the eroticism more easily.
Okay, and thank you. I recall a review of that novel by none other than Joyce Carol Oates, which basically praised the quality of your prose, but she was bewildered by the characterization of, what she perceived as the lack of characterization of Franny, and she concluded that the novel finally wasn't up to much. And I think Dear Joyce got it terribly wrong there, but the novel, and in particular Franny's characterization, did generate controversy. It was compared to the story of O, and resulted in some measure of personal discomfort for you. Would you like to give us your perspective of these responses?
The responses were extremely varied. You know, people who could not read it, and to this day I have friends who have not read it because they're afraid that it's too violent or too erotic. And that's fine. You know, I do not expect or demand that people admire my or even read my work. So, but the reviews were fine. What was alarming in many cases was the reaction of mostly men who assumed that I was the character, and nothing I said to disavow that worked. And also they began to treat me like one of the boys, you know, so that's, you know, that they would, someone would say to me, God, did you see her tits? And I would have to say, I'm not your buddy. I'm not your pal. I really don't want to discuss that woman's breasts. And you don't? No, I really don't. So it caused people to think that I was perhaps looser in a sexual sense and more masochistic than in fact I am.
And what about the comparison to the story of O, the idea that Franny had a death wish? Would you like to speak to that?
Yes, because that was very upsetting too. And also the difference of the story of O is I hope that readers will find in the cut it in places funny or amusing. If there was one thing that I could, you know, if one could go back, I cannot read ever any of my work because I am too busy fixing it. I see too much that's not right. And one of the things that I would fix in the cut is I would make it very clear that she is not a masochist or trying to get killed. And I think I failed in some subtle way not to make that as clear as it should be.
Okay. Although that's changed, hasn't it? It's changed with the times. You have female readers now who are much more responsive to or understanding of the character of Franny, don't you? Perhaps we'll get to that. I just wanted to ask you that. So in what ways is Franny a dangerous woman?
She's dangerous in that, most dangerous, most women who are called dangerous because they ask uncomfortable questions and also, refuse to behave in a way that would be considered, I guess you would say, safe. You know, she refuses to comply with the conventions that say that rape or her any assault, sexual assault or otherwise, would be her fault. I mean, I compare it to a rather obvious image, which is, the girl going into the biker bar in hot pants, who people then say, well, what did you expect? Of course you were going to be raped. And I noticed too, when I was writing the book in that period, and again, because of working in prison, that judges, the press, the public, relatives, victims, all tended to blame the woman in those instances. And that, of course, has continued as we have seen with the Me Too movement and the way people responded to the number of women who came out after years. You know, even E. Jean Carroll in New York with Trump to talk about assault and to file charges.
That victim blaming still persists. So why do you think that a new generation of readers, including many younger feminists, have been so fervent in their appreciation of the novel? It's had this resurgence, it's been republished, and they seem to perceive your intention so much more clearly. They see the novel as subversive, which it is, and they praise it for revealing language as the matrix through which class, gender and race operate. And they're not bewildered by your characterisation of Franny. So what do you think has changed? Why this different reception, this different response to the novel?
Well, I think, of course, it has a lot to do with feminism. I mean, the book was published, almost 30 years ago. Mm. So during that time, a lot has changed for women. Mm. And they are less tolerant of the tendency to blame the victim. They're more aware of their own sexuality. There's been a lot of talk lately in New York, because there are a few books about the fad now for what's called polyamory, that it's a good idea to have more than one partner, that threesomes are great, for example, which is in a way the logical next step, that a kind of sexual free-for-all in whatever sense you can imagine, is just fine. And of course it is. But it took a while. I think women have come into their own in so many ways, and self-awareness, and also the idea of alternative means of expressing themselves has been very helpful, I think.
Yes, I think so too. I think that in the initial reception to In the Cut, people were so blinded by the graphic sexuality, the portrayal of Franny, that they often missed, I think, with a lot of the humour in the novel. And for me, which is a standout aspect, is the love of language. Upon my recent rereading of the novel, I was thrilled by that aspect of the novel all over again. And so I found it especially funny in the scenes with the jaded Pauline, and I found Franny's observations of the language around her especially wonderful. And I wonder if you could share a section of that with us today, which shows her love and her playfulness with language, and about the two women she overhears when she's on the train.
You know, one of the things about misusage of language, which is what interests her as well as street talk, is that often the incorrect word more fully expresses the meaning of the word. And of course that fascinated me. And also all the things I wrote down, I heard, or someone said to me, or had written. I really did, on the subway one day, hear the woman sitting next to me say to her friend, "That man, he a trisexual," which of course completely delighted me and made me very curious. I wanted to know more, but I can read here. I've often noticed that words that are incorrectly rendered have an onomatopoetic logic, mm-hmm. as well as a kind of poetry that is more appealing and even more accurate than correct usage. Mm-hmm. The wrong words are sometimes so close to a truer meaning that they are like puns. Many of the words have to do with the body or disease. For example, Alzheimer's disease rather than Alzheimer's. Abominable for stomach. Athletic fit for epileptic fit. Chicken pops. Very close veins. And of course, the prostate gland. But there are other words too, like chomping at the bit and autumn furlage and uncharted waters, which I actually saw written not a few weeks ago in the New York Times, uncharted waters. And what could be more alluring than breastises? I looked up, this is on the train, and saw that the poetry in motion placard had been changed. The new poem was in Spanish with an English translation by Garcia Lorca, full of words like remanso, which means still waters, and fronda de luceres, or frond of stars. But the word that thrilled me was espessura. I whispered it many times. I'm very sad to say that the poetry in motion placards no longer exist on the trains. Perhaps there were too few of us who were reading them, but they were a great solace.
They're used, that the poetry on the trains is used remarkably, with remarkable effect at the conclusion of the novel In the Cut. And so those words, that presence of words and their especial meaning to Franny is right there, right to the very end. Okay, so perhaps I'll switch to setting now, which is a very distinctive, your characterizations of setting are very distinctive, and there's a potency of place in each of them, in the cut, in the Lost Wife, and also in your own memoir, and it's as though place has the power to infiltrate the soul. And there's a section in your latest book, The Lost Wife, which I'll just read as an example of that intersection between personality and place. And she's gone out and she's walking on the plains. She's based at Yellow Medicine, a Sioux agency. Her husband is a doctor there, and they're making their life in this place. She's a restless soul, this woman. She's never really had a home, and it is this place that I think that she finds her place. You can read the book to find out what the outcome of that is. But she says here, I left the house alone this afternoon, walking north for an hour in the hope of finding someone who might have seen the French girl and her baby. They'd been lost out on the plains. I stopped at the farm of a Wapitan chief named John the other day and spoke to a young white couple who looked like runaways themselves, barely in their teens and living in a dilapidated cabin on his farm. But they had not seen the girl or her child. John other day said there was a pack of wolves living in a den not far from his farm. He said to be sure I was home by dark, as he saw them last night near his stock pen. Or better still, I thought, home by twilight, the hour of the wolf, as my mother used to like to say. I continued walking. A mysterious elation began to overtake me, seeming to grow the farther I was from home. I felt the world pressing against me, and I began to tremble. The air, flattened and still, held me tightly. The enormity of it, the air, the prairie and the sky and the rushing rivers no longer frightens me, but fill me with joy. Such beauty. I felt a sudden deep thrill of gratitude. But to whom? When it began to alarm me, I turned around. I think that's a beautiful, beautiful description of that walk, Susanna. Thank you for that. But I want to speak initially, more generally, about place in your novel and all these places, and none more so than your first three novels. This Hawaiian infusion of the soul that is within them continues in this huge variety of settings or worlds that you create so well for the reader. There's a women's prison. There's India, Europe in World War II, and in your most recent novel, The Lost Wife, in Yellow Medicine, the Indian agency in Minnesota in the mid-1800s. This is a novel of a terrible tale of the dispossession of the Sioux, not unlike the many tales we have here in our own country of the dispossession of Indigenous people. But can you tell us what led you to this most recent setting? What was the catalyst to visit this world?
I have a habit of, if I find a book that interests me or a subject, to read everything I can find about it. And so I had picked up a book on what is called captivity narratives. And there was another book published by Penguin called Women's Narratives of Abduction. And it was fascinating, but there was one in it that caught my attention by Sarah Wakefield, because it was late. It was 1862. Mm. which is already, it was during the Civil War. There were railroads, there were telegraphs, there were newspapers. It wasn't as isolated or intrusive, so to speak, a community as the earlier abductions, which were all in New England in the 17th and 18th century. So I thought, well, this is interesting because it's so recent, really. And she wrote her own version of what happened to her abduction, which I then read. I found that. And I didn't altogether believe her. And that got me to thinking, as I often do about most things, what is really going on here? What is really happening? What is she really saying and thinking and feeling? And so I guess the only way to explain it is I decided to make it up, because there's a lot of the book that's made up.
Yeah.
Almost all of it until she is abducted. And then I depended more on her account to be factual. But of course, in any novel, there's the literal and the factual as well as symbol and metaphor. But I'd say the first three quarters of the book is pretty metaphorical, not factual.
Did you feel any responsibility to the original Sarah Wakefield, or you did what you wanted with her? Is that?
Well, I grew to like her, as often happens when I'm writing about someone. I wanted to understand what it was that had really happened.
Yeah.
Because she, as a result of her abduction and her having been treated well by the Sioux who captured her, was, when she was rescued, vilified by both her white community and the Native American community. So she lost everything.
Yeah.
And that made her a tragic figure, which, despite her, I think, somewhat disingenuous explanation of what had happened to her, made her very sympathetic to me.
So it was her sympathy for the Indians and her honesty that made her a dangerous woman at that time, especially in light of the prevailing male privilege that was very much a feature of that era.
And also that she defended them.
Yeah.
And in fact, I think fell in love with her rescuer, but that is speculation on my part. Also, I had to have a story.
Yeah, yes, of course, yeah.
Mission that she fell in love with Chaska, her rescuer, was very helpful.
Yes, and it's a wonderful part of the novel. Sarah Brinton, look, across the three works, and in your other works, your central female characters are restless souls. They're often running from something. They're not necessarily self-aware in this way, or if they are, they're not quite sure what it is that they're running from. And Sarah Brinton is no exception to this. She constantly lies about herself, tells a lot of lies, but the reader finally comes to admire her courage in telling the truth. Would you like to speak about what you were, what your intentions were with this character, and who is she really?
Well, as I was writing, something occurred to me which I hadn't really thought about in the beginning, which was, because of course I hadn't created her, the early story, which is that this was a woman who, also I should say that I found out during my research on the real Sarah Wakefield that she was a bigamist and had abandoned a child. So, and she lies. She tells lie after lie after lie and is believed and succeeds, fools people and makes a life for herself. marries well, has money finally. And then when she finally does tell the truth, which is after she's being, after she's been rescued and is the Indians are on trial, no one believes her.
Yeah.
So there was an ironic twist to it that I hadn't, in a way, I hadn't expected.
Yes, it is. I found this particular reader's had huge admiration for Sarah by the end of the novel. I found the journey, Sarah's journey to Shakopee, much of which was by river, rather like Mark Twain. But I wanted to ask you what you were intending to show about that Midwest world of the 1860s and the lives of women in that world.
Well, you know, the whole the life of the frontier and settlers has been very romanticized. You know, the American imagination was faced in the 19th century with the promise of land from the government, free land often, which had a profound effect given the millions of uprooted people. And this has been, there's nostalgia attached to this now and romance. And I wanted to show what it was really like, especially for women, you know, how dirty it was, how rough, how dangerous, how misogynistic, how racist, how hard it was. I wanted not to make a romance out of it. I remember years ago when I read Cormac McCarthy's Blood Meridian, being so astonished and impressed because he does that so well.
Yes,
describes what it would be about the romance.
Yes, he does, and you do it so well in the novel. I found that world fascinating as I read about it. Your take on it.
I just say too that when you were talking about women in movement on the move, critics pointed out that this is a theme in much of the books, even the first one.
Yes,
not the first one, but even the Whiteness of Bones, and certainly the Indian book, certainly the Berlin book, certainly. You will have seen it, but in my eulogy to Joan, I talk about the things she said to me or tried to teach me over the years.
Yeah.
And one of them, one of the things she said, somewhat to my annoyance, was, "Stop running away." So she was right, of course.
Sorry, Suzanne, I'm not sure we caught that. Would you like to repeat it?
Stop running away.
Yeah.
Mm. As I said, I was annoyed a little bit when she first said it. And then on thinking about it, it is what I have done my whole life, you know, leaving home at 17 and of course, it's what these women do.
Yeah.
These women are all running the same.
Yeah.
Some to better effect than others.
Did you realize that more fully as you worked on Miss Aluminum?
No, I realized it more after The Lost Wife when at my book party, there was a toast. I mean, I had thought about it, but I hadn't really thought that other people had thought about it, except some, as I said, some critics mention it. And someone toasted me as, "Here is to the lost wife."
Yeah.
And I thought, for an instant, well, that's an odd phrasing to toast the book, but that's fine. And then I realized they were toasting me.
Yeah.
I was the lost. So I thought.
That seems a good moment to turn to Miss Aluminum. And in fact, like the two previous books we've discussed today, it's another world in which females are preyed upon relationships are complicated, things are endured, and your central female character, you, is a restless soul in search of herself. You say at one point after, when you're trying to work out a path to breaking up with the person with whom you're currently romantically involved, I think it was Doug Netta, you say there, my inability to imagine a future for myself had kept me from thinking too deeply about our attachment. And that could be said of Franny, that could also be said of Sarah Brinton in the novels we've looked at, isn't it? It's interesting the way these things buried deep within the psyche will out, won't they, as when you're an artist and when you're a writer. But memoir's very sexy. Go on.
Lisa, I think in both their cases and even my own, it had to do with either the death or the abandonment by a mother.
Yes.
And deciding, learning as a child about the impermanence of everything and the hopelessness, the inefficiency of planning too far ahead.
Yes. And you actually replicate problems with mothers in both in The Cut for Franny, whose mother only loved her own mother, and also for Sarah Brinton, whose mother is, hardly a mother. Yeah. So, it's interesting the way this plays, these themes play out across the body of your work. These memoirs are kind of that dominate the bestseller lists. They've replaced the self-help genre as the latest place to seek life-changing inspiration. But Miss Aluminum reads almost like a lesson on things not to do. And I wonder what led you to go on that path of reflection and introspection that you inevitably have to follow in a serious approach to writing well about your life.
Well, I certainly didn't want it to be, paradigmatic, and I also was very intent on avoiding anything that portrayed or allowed you to think that I thought of myself as a victim, because I don't. And I also didn't want to victimize anybody else. So that was a starting point. No victims in this, no blame. Just, again, I suppose it's the way I wrote about sex, which is just the facts, ma'am. You know, just keep it very, it was all right for me to speculate about things and to think, but never, ever to fall into victimhood or blame or, you know, regret was one thing, guilt is okay. But I wanted very much to keep it in a way, without bad characters, although there are bad characters
yes,
in it.
Yes, there certainly are. I mean, you might not have blamed them, but I did, as I read and recently reread the book. The memoir's been referred to by one reviewer as being Dickensian. It centres on the film of and fashion world. It contains extraordinary records of extraordinary friendships throughout Susanna's life and the lifelong friendship she enjoyed with Joan Didion. But it's full of tragicomic moments. You laugh out loud as well, or you think, my God, what was she thinking? and I'd love it if you could please, I think that tragicomic element is captured wonderfully in the anecdote about you being Miss Aluminum. And I wondered if you could read that for us quickly before we finalise the session today.
I should preface it by saying in Honolulu, our neighbour was a woman called Allie Kaiser, who was the wife of the industrialist and shipbuilder Henry Kaiser. And when my mother died in my childhood and when I left home at 17, she took an interest in me, if often not very practical and sometimes quite eccentric. So I had written to her that I was so poor, I was looking for a second job. A week after I wrote to Ali, I received a call from a marketing executive at the Aluminum Association who wished to let me know that I was one very lucky young lady. He wanted to be the first to tell me that I'd been chosen that year's Miss Aluminum. I was mystified, suspecting that it was a crank call, until I remembered that Mr. Kaiser had interest in metals, including aluminum. I was to fly to New York to be fitted for my Miss Aluminum costume, after which my first appearance would be at a boat trade show at the Coliseum, where the Aluminum Association was promoting the use of their product in the manufacture of boats. I would be paid $100 a day, which was a fortune to me, plus my airfare and lodging at a hotel near the convention center. Without giving it much thought, as appeared to be my habit, I graciously accepted the title and went to New York. The Coliseum was packed with men who'd come to see the new boats. The few women present were models like me. My costume was a tight, sleeveless sheath in a glittering silver material, so rough with sequins that it chafed the insides of my arms. I wore silver mesh pantyhose a bit thick and silver high heels with wide ankle straps, and carried a long, somewhat unsteady wand made of taped together cardboard tubes meant to be a trident, wrapped in tinfoil and pasted with glitter. When I saw a Miss Panama billfish tournament in a towering headdress that caused her to look more like a stegosaurus than a marlin, and a girl in a bikini who represented a designer of expensive yachts splayed on a simulated deck while a sheepish male model in a white tuxedo, flushed with the heat, offered her hour after hour a liquid meant to be a daiquiri, which perhaps it was, in which she drank in two desperate gulps. I realized then that it could have been worse. Boat show lasted for the weekend, after which there was a dinner at 21 for an exclusive group of yacht owners given by one of the executives at Kaiser, which I was expected to attend, wearing my silver dress and carrying my wand. The men on either side of me, both in blue yachting blazers with crests on the breast pockets, were polite, but not particularly thrilled to be placed next to a dazed 20-year-old with streaks of glitter on her face. One of the men asked me, not unkindly, "Who are you supposed to be anyway, Tinkerbell?" Halfway through dinner, to my own surprise, I began to cry and ran to the toilet, where the attendant stared at me for a moment before she whispered, "Oh, honey, get yourself home."
Thank you. That's the wonder of Susanna's writing. She just shows us, and we get it. It's wonderful. Finally, I miss out. You were actually due to go to Sydney Writers Festival when COVID broke out, and Miss Aluminum had just been published. And one of the reasons why you were invited to that festival was that they saw Miss Aluminum as emerging from the zeitgeist that brought us the Me Too movement. Would you like to comment on that?
I think it was a little bit before. Certainly it did. It was connected, and it was very evident to me in the interviews and talks I did later, usually conducted by young women based on their questions, you know, things that they found offensive in the book. And also I learned that the word rape now applies to all kinds of sexual assault, not just vaginal or anal penetration. But one of the things that interested me was there was great irritation and anger at the story I tell about Warren Beatty asking me to lift my skirt to show my legs when I went to see him for a job interview to become a script reader, and which I did. I did lift my skirt, at which point he said, "Can you start tomorrow?" Which I thought was funny. I still think it's funny. He thought was funny. I suspect he had already decided that I would get the job, but this seemed, I think because of Me Too, to be very offensive to a lot of women who said to me, "How could you have done that? What's wrong with you? Why did you do that?" And when I would say, "Well, it was funny," they were not convinced.
Do you get a lot of questions about Oleg Cassini's assault, rape of you?
Did I get a lot of questions about that? Mm-hmm. No, there was not a lot about that, interestingly, except that it was I was asked about it, it was referred to as rape, and I first, not knowing how the language had changed, said, no, I was not raped, it was a sexual assault. Mm-hmm. And so I was corrected and learned how the word, the meaning of the word has changed.
Yeah.
And that's because of Me Too also.
Yes. So much good has come out of that. Finally, my friend, to be a bit cheeky, would you describe Susanna Moore as a dangerous woman?
I don't think I'm dangerous. Such a hard question. Do I think of myself? I think others may think I am, or be intimidated or alarmed, although I've become much quieter and more placid as I've aged. I don't think I'm dangerous. I think I was when I was younger, in that I was a little bit, I was wild and provocative and also very intent on being an equal to any man. Which I don't feel this any longer, I'm happy to say.
Thanks, Susanna. I think on that point, we'll let Susanna go. We won't have questions today. Is anybody burning with a question? We'll let Susanna go at this point. She loves this. She loves Adelaide. She loves this spot in the gardens. And I'm so glad she's been able to visit with us today and give us so many insights into herself as a writer. Go on, Susanna.
No, I just said I do love Adelaide, and it was a place I would like to live if I did not have grandchildren. I thought about it, as you recall.
Yes. My shy hope was that you would come and live here. But can we give her a big, show our appreciation for her generosity? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. See you, dear.